for Americans and the world at large about the systemic change that needs to take place in order to make sure that our society is working for working people and the vast majority of us. And hopefully we can build off of this and find some silver lining in this crisis.
Yeah, everybody stay safe. Please go to census.gov to take part in the census, or to type in your information that you received for the census. And please remember to try to social distance as much as possible. Work from home if available. Yeah, wash your hands. And to make sure that you limit the spread of misinformation.
Yes, indeed. Very important. Well, everyone out there, thank you so much for listening. Stay safe.
Yep.
We will come to you again next month. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilliland.
Yeah, until next time, stay safe.
Thanks.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is day four of our partial station shutdown on the COVID-19 occurrence. We are about to go to Prison Pipeline, coming up right next.
Hi, greetings and welcome to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. Tonight we're here with Daniel McGowan. How you doing, Daniel?
Hey, what's up, Adam?
Thanks
for having me on.
Of course, always. Hey, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? We might have some listeners who might not be familiar with you, or your case, or your present community organizing.
Sure thing. My name is Daniel McGowan. I'm a New Yorker, born and raised out here in Queens. I used to live in the Northwest. I was indicted as part of the Earth Liberation Front case in 2005, and I did 7 years in prison. I was housed at this place called the Communication Management Unit, which was sort of a repressive unit that they put political folks in to sort of silence us from talk about what's going on in the world. I've been out of prison since 2013. Been organizing, doing a lot of political prisoner support. One of the projects that I work a lot on is Certain Days, the Freedom for Political Prisoners calendar. So I was going to talk a little bit about that today, if that's cool.
We certainly hope so. and that is at certaindays.org. And there's other ways of finding it online as well, but that would be first and foremost. So, yeah, tell us about the project and how you got involved.
Sure thing. I was just telling someone the other day how I ended up meeting one of the people on Certain Days. We actually met through the social media like site Friendster back in the day, which is really like, I feel like really dates me. But anyhow, so I met Sarah through Friendster and somehow found out about Certain Days. That was around 2003 or 2004. And I started, you know, over the years working on it sporadically, you know, submitting articles or helping out. But when I got out of prison, really, that's when I joined the collective. And so I've been working on it about 6 years now. And just to give you guys a little background about our project, Certain Days is a political prisoner calendar. It's essentially an art and educational project and a fundraiser. So we're in our 19th year, and it's a project that's done between organizers in Montreal, Hamilton, Canada, and New York and Baltimore. And we're an inside-outside collective, so we essentially work with people on the inside. So currently, people that we are working with is David Gilbert, a political prisoner from New York, and Sinoxley, who is a political prisoner in Texas. Recently, for many years, we were, there were three inside collective members, but we were lucky enough to welcome home founding members Herman Bell and Robert Seth Hayes in 2018. So we kind of reformed our collective and added a few new people.
That's great project.
But yeah,
can you say more about the political prisoners as far as what that means? Because some people have different, you know, definitions, and obviously in this project really kind of sticks out. It's focusing a lot on these kind of long-term U.S.-held political prisoners. There's others, sure, too, but it's very, you know, North American-based and really around certain, sure, cases, politics, political organizations, right?
Yeah, I would say, of course, you know, incarceration or imprisonment takes place in a political context, and I'm certainly not, mm-hmm, suggesting that people that are in prison are divided into, you know, these categories of important or non-important or whatever, you know, good or bad or whatever. I mean, we use these words sometimes, political prisoner or social prisoner, but of course incarceration takes place in a political context, and like there's oppression that takes place against the majority of the people that are in prison. So, but I think, you know, I can say for myself, the reason that I had been drawn to working on political prisoner issues is I felt like these were folks that I had a lot of respect for that were from our movement.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I say our movements, I guess I could refer to, you know, movements for like black liberation from the 60s and 70s and 80s, Puerto Rican independence, anarchist, you know, prisoners that were taking action against capitalism and the state, environmental and animal rights prisoners. I'm missing one for some reason. Sorry.
A lot of movements.
I guess, you know, yeah, a lot of different movements. You know, people, you know, some of these people are, you know, a good majority of them are elders or people that I think are good examples of not just like how to be principled, you know, in prison, but also just like, you know, the movements that they were part of. I mean, a lot of the people we're talking about have deep histories and movements for social justice, whether it's, you know, Students for a Democratic Society, resistance against the Vietnam War. You know, I was just, for instance, I was just at a memorial for Tom Manning, who passed away, mm-hmm, in July, and that was a really impressive movement. A memorial with a bunch of movement elders, you know, principled, like, elder white people who, you know, I think if you are, you know, European American, you struggle to find examples of people, especially elders, that have lived righteous lives and are fighting racism and white supremacy in a way that's like not tokenistic or short term. Mm-hmm. And so I was pretty in awe at this event, looking at, you know, these people that are largely my parents' age but live, you know, pretty intense lives. So, you know, people like Tom Manning and Bill Dunn and David Gilbert, Jan Lamont, people like that, I've always been impressed by. But, you know, there's people in all movements that I think have something to offer. So I guess, you know, with the limited time that I have on this planet and my life, I just, you know, I want to, you know, at least since I've got out of prison, focus on getting these people from the 60s and 70s and 80s out of prison and living the rest of their lives, you know, in relatively freedom out here, you know.
Yeah, that's great. And then you provide this particular resource, which is, it's interesting because, I mean, it's really like, it's beyond a calendar, right? I mean, it's a calendar, yeah, as far as like that's the kind of the outcome that somebody would, you know, go and yeah, you know, can go pick one up or whatever. At the same, sure, time, you know, there's all this information that's in them.
Sure.
And for people who aren't familiar with their cases, sometimes it's a great way to learn kind of about them because there's the writings and all, sure, the artwork and things like that. So can you talk about how sure, this kind of links in with all these other resources and kind of how it's put together?
Well, it's funny, you know, we have like, we always joke about the fact that some of the sections of the calendar, you know, we tweak it every year, but there's not massive changes,
mm-hmm,
to perhaps some of the sections. Like we have like a section of definitions, we have like website list and book list, books we really love, which is a very hard section to edit, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And just like updates and things like that. Now those sections, like, you know, might change like 25%, whereas the art and the articles is 100% new every year. So we know that, you know, the fact is that we continue to sell, you know, thousands of calendars leads me to believe that, you know, people are not just using it as a wall calendar. It's really more, I always think of it as like a really big zine, and it's something that I think is really great to give to new people.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that new people new to the movement or new to prisoner issues. I mean, we don't just talk about political prisoner issues. We talk about, you know, we're abolitionists. We talk about all kinds of issues affecting, you know, imprisonment in this country and this continent, and really the world. But, you know, so I will say that, like, I'm really excited about this year. Our calendar has a theme every year. This theme is knitting together the struggle. We come up with this theme through like consultation with people on the inside, We write like an essay typically on that theme, and then we give that idea to the artist and authors. And we have sort of an open call, and we also do a little bit of solicited kind of targeting, asking people, specific people. So this year, like I said, it's knitting together the struggles. So it's about a little bit about intersectionality and movements working together. We have art and articles by a number of really awesome authors and artists, including Annie Morgan Banks, Eric McBay, Cindy Milstein, David Gilbert, Eric King, Fernando Marti, Jan Lamon, Marius Mason, No New Jails Coalition, Stevie Wilson, Mary Tremonte. There's a few others. I'm not going to say the whole list. But I'm really happy about the content. It's pretty inspiring. You know, we like to group our art and our articles in some kind of thematic way, so you'll see like similarities between the art. We have a lot of first-time contributors this year. We have probably, you know, 6 or 7 people inside that contributed. So I think it'll be really solid. The other thing I mentioned is that our project is a fundraiser. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're like a 6-person collective on the outside and 2 people on the inside right now. It's obviously an all-volunteer thing. So once we pay for the printer, you know, and the cost of postage, which are, you know, really our only cost, we have 2 beneficiaries every year. And then we choose a few others. So the sort of permanent beneficiaries are Release Aging People in Prison, mm-hmm. the RAP campaign in New York. Then we have a group called Adamir, which is a political prisoner organization in Palestine that looks out for the, you know, thousands of political prisoners in Israeli prisons. Last year, one of our beneficiaries is this pretty young project that's doing excellent work called the Amistad Law Project in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And in previous years, we've given from to the No Olympics campaign in Canada, the Abolitionist Law Center, the Unist'ot'en Indigenous Blockade in Canada, Freedom Archives, For Struggle Magazine. We kind of pick different ones. And in recent years, we also put aside a little money for release funds because there's been a number of political prisoners, you know, over 20 that have gotten out since 2015. And often those people have been in for 30, 40 years. And so we like to make contributions to release funds as well. And this last year has been challenging because, you know, there's like 4 new people got out, mm-hmm. Which is just, you know, exciting, but also like it's, you know, it's a lot, right? So.
Right. And meanwhile, you have people getting out. There's people who are passing away. And then there's like new political prisoners, you know, new people getting locked up.
Definitely.
And you always seem, you know, among kind of the larger national cohort of folks doing political prisoner work, you know, at the forefront of really knowing kind of what's going on with all these people and their cases and who they are. Can you talk about that? Because I think for a lot of people, even if they're sort of familiar with this concept, okay, yes, we have long-term U.S.-held political prisoners, mm-hmm. still not really clear. I mean, who are these people? You know, how did they find out about them? And, you know, because again, like I said, some of the community organizers involved nationally, like, I mean, you know, they're getting phone calls from family members, you know, the moment something happens to somebody you know, this quick alert kind of. So how does that work?
I mean, I think for me, Adam, a lot of it is just like I've been around for a long time. I mean, going on a little over 20 years now. And so I had been involved in prisoner work and political prisoner work and environmental campaigning, right? So I think after I got out, what started to happen was people would reach out to me when, like, you know, they're like, yo, my friend caught a case, could you talk to their family? And so I sort of started doing a lot of this like kind of low-key consulting, because I find like the prison system, and you know, I was in the federal prison system, it's pretty obtuse and none of it makes a lot of sense. And mm-hmm. so you have people who perhaps their family members have never dealt with incarceration before. And so suddenly, you know, like with my family, I was just snatched out of my workplace. I was put in a local jail and then I was shipped across the country to Oregon within like a week. So, you know, I had, you know, my family and my friends had a pretty deep learning curve. So like I have like many times, like, you know, sort of got to people early and been able to kind of let them know what's going on. Be like, oh, they're in Oklahoma. Okay, here's the locator. Here's how you find out where they are. Here's how you put money in the books. Here's what your loved one is facing. And try to, you know, assuage people's fears, but also give them, like, you know, reality talk about, like, what's going on. So I would say in the last, like, you know, 6 years, you know, it's got to the point I work with a number of different organizations and we're sort of just tapped into the network of information. But really, I rely on social media for some of this. I rely on personal relationships. I rely on good old fashioned listservs. I guess I will, if it's okay, I will give you guys two updates on two younger political prisoners that are dealing with some tough situations right now.
Yeah, that's sure. Cool. Just letting folks know, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. We're here with Daniel McGowan talking about the 2020 Get Them While They're Hot CertainDays.org calendar. So look, CertainDays.org, it's a 2020 calendar focusing on U.S. long-term held political prisoners, and Daniel's going to tell us some more about some of these particular special people.
Yeah. Okay, so I just want to shout out two youngish anarchist political prisoners in the federal system. Right now, they're dealing with some tough cases. The first is Eric King. Eric King is from the Midwest. He's doing a 10-year sentence for attempted arson. I believe it was of a congressional representative's office in reaction to Ferguson uprising and that particular representative's viewpoint, or regressive viewpoint on the protest. So Eric was doing a 10-year sentence, was out of a low security prison, got bounced to this medium security prison, FCI Florence. He was assaulted by a lieutenant after being called into his office to discuss some outgoing email that Eric sent, at least that's the claim. Eric was assaulted by this cop, spent roughly 270 days in segregation over the last 2 years, and then was indicted secretly by a grand jury in May, and then he was just brought back to Colorado. So he is currently, on top of his 10-year sentence, facing an assault charge of a federal official, and he's currently being housed in segregation at FCI Englewood. I read the indictment. It's pretty it's pretty simple. It looks like almost like he said, she said kind of thing. But Eric, unfortunately, the charge carries a maximum of 20 years in prison. While I want to hope that, a judge or jury could see between the lines that, what really happened, that is the truth, that is what he's facing as a maximum. Whether or not he would get that much is beyond me. Mm-hmm. And so Eric is in segregation. He has a new lawyer. They're in the process called discovery, where they get all the documents, and he's definitely he's on 23-hour lockdown minimum, and so he can definitely need your help and support. You can find out information about him at supporericking.org. That's, supporericking.org. He also has a Facebook group with the same name that you can easily find. You just search that, Support Eric King. The second person is my boy Jeremy Hammond. He is a hacker doing, a 10-year sentence, an anarchist hacker from Chicago. He released documents related to this global surveillance company called Stratfor. We call the Stratfor hacks. He's got a 10-year sentence out of New York City. It seems that Jeremy has been subpoenaed to a federal grand jury in Alexandria, Virginia. There's not really a lot known right now. He's being held at this detention center out there. And, you can get his address and updates from freejeremy.net. He also has a very active Twitter handle that supporters run for him. That's at freejeremynet. So there's not a lot of updates right now, but those are two of the younger generation of political prisoners that are already doing a bunch of time and are facing more time. And one of the reason Jeremy's facing time is there's this thing called civil contempt of a grand jury. And if a person refuses to cooperate with a grand jury, the judge has the ability to freeze their federal sentence, and essentially as a coercive tool to get them to cooperate. So Jeremy is already, looking at more time based on that. So these are two younger dudes that could definitely use some support. So I wanted to make sure y'all heard about that before I knocked off here.
Yeah, well, it's interesting too, because with Jeremy's case, for example, with all this online type activism, and there's been so many other cases where the system has really thrown the book at people involved with things related to the internet and kind of release of information. There was, that one person who, unfortunately, they took their lives, who were, they were going to get a life sentence for exposing, Aaron Schwartz, releasing the articles from JSTOR and things like that. And the way that, and even in your case, right, you know, these post 9/11 cases where terrorism really meant like a different thing sort of at one point and then took on whole new definitions, and then there's so much else that goes under that category now. So many things that go under that category, and so many other things that don't go under that category, like vigilante white supremacist groups that, you know, should be in that category, and they're not really deemed as much in that light. But then, however, we have this whole cohort of activists. And so, I mean, can you kind of talk about sort of that dynamic, how that's relating to the effects on people with these cases?
I mean, I think one of the major reasons why the perception is that the vigilante, like, white supremacists aren't, it's because it's like industry is not organized against them. Like capitalism and capitalists and corporations don't care. Mm-hmm. You know, they just don't care about white supremacists. It just doesn't affect their bottom line to some extent, I guess. Whereas you have obviously groups on the left that are attacking corporations or this capitalism are perceived as, you know, righteously scary, I guess, or enemies of their business interests. And so you have, you know, industry actively organized, and it's why, you know, my case and a lot of other cases, like environmental activists or anarchists, are being treated like monsters, essentially. So yeah, it's definitely frightening. There's a lot of, you know, people that have been dealing with this. Chelsea Manning is, you know, on day 200 of civil contempt in that same in that same city, Alexandria, Virginia. You have that former soldier, reality winner, in federal prison. So it's really funny to hear people say, what about the whistleblowers? And then you see, like, wait, what about Jeremy and Chelsea Manning? Like, they're whistleblowers. Like, you're just, like, using the term, and, you know, you're not seeing that for whatever reason. But I guess I also just, Adam, wanted to make sure that I let you all know how to get this calendar.
Yeah.
Because I'd hate to tell you how awesome it is, and then you don't know how to get it. So, like Adam said, certaindays.org is, like, if you can remember one, that's the easiest place to go. You have links to how to get the calendar. But I will say, if you're in the United States, which I imagine a lot of your listeners are, you can go, you know, our main distributor is Burning Books in Buffalo. It's burningbooks.com. You can buy one for $15, and if you buy 10 or more, the price falls to $10. And so what a lot of groups do is they buy 10 or more for $10 each. The shipping is free, and then they sell them for $15. So essentially, if you know, if you buy $100 of calendars, 10 calendars, you sell them for 15 and you keep $5, you make $50. So a lot of different small groups, small shops, info shops, and bookstores do that, and it's a nice little way that they can make, you know, make a little money.
Right.
If you're in Canada, you can get it through our site, or you can get it from Left Wing Books, aka Chris Lebedev. International, like around Asia and Europe, you can get it from Active Distribution, which is a big punk distribution in London. We also have this thing where you can buy a calendar for only $8 for anyone that's in prison and jail, and there's a button that's on our website. So you basically just pay $8. We send it for you with an invoice or a receipt, so it's very legit. We know about all the mail restrictions, so we're able to send it in properly. And then there's information on our site where you can find out what stores across the continent will stock it. So as soon as we're printed, we send it out to all these stores. There's usually about 50 to 100 stores in the continent that sells our calendar. And of course, there's also AK Press, akpress.org, and they're one of our major distributors, and they have a lot of really awesome books, obviously. So so I highly recommend, if you're going to buy bulk, buy more than 10. You'd be surprised how fast you can sell them, or give them away for the holidays. We kind of get a little obnoxious promoting it as a stocking stuffer. Come November, we just, like, it's like nonstop. And a lot of people, you know, I find a lot of people do that. And I to be honest, I used to do it before I was a member of the collective. I would buy a ton and just give them away because I think they're pretty awesome presents. You give it to your racist uncle, you give it to your younger sister who's, like, you know, questioning stuff, whatever. And you can find us, like I said, on certaindays.org. But we're on Facebook with our name, you know, Certain Days. We're at Certain Days on Twitter, and we're at Certain Days Calendar on Instagram. So we're pretty hard, you know, to find, even possibly overexposed on social media. I post a lot, obviously, as you know.
Yeah, I know. And that's what I was saying about this kind of wealth of resources that is there. And even on the Certain Days website, you know, looking at the political prisoner sites, and there's, you know, almost some of the, well, I don't know how you want to frame it, but, you know, so many of the political prisoners do have their own support teams, and support networks and websites, and that's definitely reflected on this particular list here. And then there's, you know, the different ABC and Jericho lists and stuff like that. Have some other prisoners on there. In context of, you know, you're talking about the whole global thing, you know, where, you know, people are online and all over, you know, other parts of North America, what have you, and dialoguing with folks. What about within the newer kind of local scene these days, what might be some things in the last couple minutes that we have that you might want to highlight as far as like ongoing work, whether it's political prisoner related or not, or just prison related kind of community organizing that you see as successful
in
New York City? Yeah, New York City. Yeah, for any listeners kind of curious what kind of things are happening on the ground there, what kind of campaigns.
Absolutely. It's actually a campaign that I'm not super involved in, but I've been like a big fan. I've been watching it like crazy. I'm sorry, I just spaced out for a second. No New Jails is a really awesome coalition. You know, there's been numerous groups fighting jail construction in New York City, and some have, you know, seemingly capitulated to the politician demands for taking 10 years to close Rikers, but No New Jails is not one of those groups, and they are keeping it real. I follow them on Twitter. We obviously are printing something by them in the calendar. I'm very happy to do that. They are totally keeping it real because politicians are doing this thing where they say they're going to close Rikers, which is technically in Queens, but it's in the river, in the middle of nowhere, basically. It's possible to get to. Mm-hmm. And then they want to open up 4 new jails. So they talk about how Rikers is only at, you know, 6,000, 7,000 people only, by the way, which is just insane. But then they talk about how they're going to close the island, but they're going to open up new jails in all the 4 of the 5 boroughs, which I just find to be madness. And it's kind of like that old joke about traffic. Like, if you build a road, you're going to fill it up. Mm-hmm, it's like, if you build prisons, like, they will have an imperative to fill it up. And I just do not understand that. So you got No New Jails right now, just like, I mean, they're legit. They are like disrupting city council. They're out there in the street giving out flyers, letting people know what's up. Recently, Angela Davis spoke in New York City, and she made a comment about Ford Foundation and their role in promoting the idea of new jail construction. And lo and behold, on Twitter today, No New Jails talking about Ford Foundation. I mean, they are like legit and cutting edge. And I think I'm very inspired by that. Because, you know, I work a lot on what people might consider the back end, you know, prison. Prison is like once people already go through the system. But, like, you know, New York's prison population has fallen pretty dramatically in the last 20 years. And a lot of that is because of the front end work. So all that work that's done to mess, you know, to restrict the police from doing what they do, their nonsense, but also, like, alternatives to incarceration, getting charges reduced from felonies to misdemeanors. I mean, that's how you shrink it, right? I mean, it's not destroying it, but it is definitely making it a lot smaller than it used to be. When I was a kid, Rikers Island, which is like 100 years ago, Rikers Island was 20,000 people at one point. It is now 7,000 people. So we live in a different world, and we need to, like, that world we live in should not have 4 new jails in New York City. Jail construction is to me a racket, and somebody's getting paid. I don't know who it is, but it's probably politicians. And so I just would say No New Jails is who you really want to follow. And I'm sure you can find them online really easy on Twitter, because that's what I've been doing.
Right, yeah, No New Jails. And then, and also RAP seems very progressive coalition of kind of consortium organizations.
Yeah, RAP.
Working on different stuff.
RAP is excellent. Release Aging People in Prison. I mean, I'm biased. They're one of the beneficiaries of the calendar, but I think they do amazing work. They are dealing with this, like, 9,500 people that are in the prison system in New York State that are elderly. And, you know, in prison, when you talk about elderly, that's 55 and over. Partially due to the lack of medical care and neglect that takes place. So you have like close to 10,000 people out of 46,000 people that are elderly, and those people like are in serious need of like medical parole and compassionate release. We got a governor that doesn't do any of that. He's like a fake progressive, and he fronts and he pretends, but he has given 18 people clemency in 8 years. But 1,000 people have died in the prison system since he's been the governor in the same period of time. So that's a ratio that's just garbage. And I think RAP is really, RAP is engaged in culture change as well as just straight up organizing. So I have a lot of respect for them. Well, they're really awesome.
Well, that people. That is a wrap and a good wrap and a wrap up for the show. And you've been listening to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Big thanks to our guest, Daniel McGowan. certaindays.org. Look, that 2020 calendar is coming out soon. And our engineer, Selena, thank you so much. Free them all.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. We are also on K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. You're listening to KBOO on day four of our COVID-19 partial station shutdown. Just to go off of what Adam was just talking about, COVID-19 poses the greatest risk of death to the elderly as well as to those who are immunocompromised. And in the California prison system, one in seven people are aged 55 or older. People in this age group are at the greatest risk for death from COVID-19, yet pose the least public safety risk to the community. So there are about 20 groups that have put together a letter to California Governor Gavin Newsom calling for the state to release all medically fragile adults and adults over the age of 60 to parole supervision. And that is, they are talking about how it is very likely that this will spread into a prison, one prison or another, and when that happens, that will spread like wildfire, even faster than it would in a school. They're also calling on the governor to release all people who have anticipated release dates in 2020 and 2021 to do early release and to expedite all review processes for people already found suitable for release, lift holds, and expedite the commutation process. As well, they are calling for an immediate suspension of all unnecessary parole meetings, eliminate parole revocations for technical violations, i.e. sending someone back into prison, and lift all fees.